Apoptosis going mad, my liver's gonna fail. Maybe it's from the radium I use to paint my nails. Well, say you hate me, carbon date me, throw me in the sea. I'll be back with time because I'm made of stardust and chemistry. Of stardust and chemistry.
Hello, and welcome to Cowboy Chemistry, where we talk about the wilder days of chemistry. My name is Dylan Gardner. My pronouns are they, them, and I'm a PhD candidate at Texas Tech University. My guest today is Selena Martinez, official head of Laugh Hub City. So how are you today, Selena?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
Whatever day of the week it is.
It's a Wednesday. It's 4:20.
Oh, that's right. It is 4:20. I see that on TikTok.
Responsibly.
All day. TikTok all day. Yeah. So I ask every guest, how much do you know about chemistry?
I used to know a lot. Like, not about the history or anything, but just about, like, the math part of it. Like, sort of geometry. I used to be really good at that, like, in school and stuff, because it was just math.
Yeah.
And I can do math. Like, it's easy. It's just, like, you know, plug numbers in. Stuff. It's not... I can do that stuff, but as far as, like, remembering who... came up with what theory of what, no idea.
Got you.
I'm bad with names and times and places.
Yeah, I mean, none of that's actually important to chemistry. Okay. Yeah, a lot of people like to, like, because there's a bunch of named reactions that are named after somebody, and I'm like, I don't remember any of those.
I know the Maillard reaction.
The Maillard reaction?
Yeah. Just browning for food.
Yeah.
I mean, I know how to apply chemistry when it comes to cooking, but outside of that, no idea.
I feel like cooking is not really chemistry, but, like, baking is chemistry. That's how
cooking
I feel about it.
Can be chemistry depending on what you're making.
That's fair.
Like, if you're making, like a carbonara, where you don't want to make scrambled eggs.
Where you don't want to make scrambled
eggs? Because carbonara has eggs in it, like egg yolks. That's what makes it soft. That's what makes it creamy.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to make sure you're not cooking it at such a high temperature that you're making scrambled eggs.
Oh, like tempered.
Yeah.
They're called tempered eggs, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but you're still cooking. Like, it's still cooked, but it's not.
Same thing with, what's that one called?
It's like a creme brulee or anything like that.
Yes, creme brulee. Mm-hmm. That's my favorite dessert of all time, and I made it once with tempered eggs.
Yeah.
I felt very proud of myself.
Yeah, trying to get it to set properly, and then you want to burn the sugar, but just not too much, you know?
Exactly. So, I kind of roped you in on this, like, last minute. But do you know anything about nitrogen when it comes to farming?
I know it's important. I do have plants in my house. And whenever there's something wrong with it, one of the Google results is always like, it's a nitrogen problem. I'm like, I don't know what to do about that. Do I crush an egg and put it in there? Or what do I, orange peels? No idea.
Well, so you need fertilizer. Is essentially what it's saying. And, like, eggshells are good if you need calcium specifically.
Right.
I don't know how much nitrogen they have. But
coffee? Does coffee? Because you can put coffee in plants, too, and it's supposed to be good for that.
So coffee is very high in nitrogen.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay.
That's a good example. Like you said, nitrogen's, like, really important for plants and specifically for fertilizer. And so today we're going to be talking about the Haber-Bosch process, and it turns nitrogen gas, like, that's just in the atmosphere, into ammonia.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is going to be, like, a three-part episode, because this is, like, a really important process. The first episode doesn't have a lot of chemistry, but we're going to talk about why the Haber-Bosch process is probably the most important invention of the 20th century.
Okay.
Like, period, the end. Honestly,
nobody's ever heard of it outside of
chemists and chemical engineers. Yeah. And I feel like they just, like, talk about, oh, the Haber-Bosch process. It's so amazing. So great. And, like, but they never tell you really why. They're just like, this is such a nifty reaction. And it is, it's a really cool reaction. Very, very sleek. It's like you put in nitrogen gas and hydrogen gas, heat it to, like, 1,000,000 degrees. That's an exaggeration. But, you know, heat it a bunch and then you get fertilizer out, which is wonderful. And, like, originally I was going to make this episode on ammonium nitrate, which ammonium nitrate is, like, an explosive, like, it explodes a lot. And so there's a lot of, like, industrial accidents with ammonium nitrate. But then after looking into, like, where ammonium nitrate comes from, it comes from the Haber-Bosch process.
Is it, like, a byproduct of it?
No, it is the product. So it makes ammonium, like ammonium and ammonium nitrate is like the major product of, of it. And so I just wanted to talk a little bit about this process and how, cause like there's been explosion, like the, we'll get, you'll see in the end, at the end of this three part episode, how, all the things that it has basically affected. Cause we'll go through, like how it, like World War One would have been 6 months long if it wasn't for the Haber-Bosch process.
How long was it for real?
4 years, I think. Four or five.
That's this.
Yeah, honestly,
I have no idea.
But I know it was a lot longer because Germany had enough nitrogen for its explosives for 6 months, and past that, it would not have been able to make any more bullets or anything without the Haber-Bosch process.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, like, we'll get into all the crazy things that it has affected, and then the other thing is like population. So, like, this artificial fertilizer has allowed us from going from a few million people to, or a few billion, like 2 billion people, to the 7 or 8 billion people we have now.
Mm-hmm.
Without that, they say that half of those people either would not have existed or starved to death.
Yeah,
because we have the fertilizer to do this. Because life needs nitrogen, and every molecule, every protein, every strand of your DNA, RNA, every cell of every plant and animal has nitrogen in it.
Okay.
But the nitrogen that we breathe in the atmosphere, which the atmosphere is 80% nitrogen, there's no way for us to use it because it's inert.
Okay.
So it has a nitrogen-nitrogen triple bond, and that triple bond is probably the most stable in all of nature.
What does that mean, inert?
Inert means it doesn't react.
Okay.
So like helium gas, right? It doesn't, you can't set it on fire. It doesn't do anything. It's inert.
Uh-huh.
So nitrogen gas is the same way. It doesn't catch on fire.
Okay.
It doesn't react with anything. For example, oxygen, if you try to set an oxygen, oxygen will make things explode, right? So, like, they say people who are on oxygen shouldn't smoke smoke cigarettes, right? Because it'll explode. If you had an intake of nitrogen, that wouldn't be a problem.
But you couldn't, like, use nitrogen as you would use oxygen.
No, you would die. Yeah, you would suffocate.
Does nitrogen do anything to your voice?
No.
Because I know, like, helium does, and then there's another one. There's another gas that makes your voice really low.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so nitrogen, again, makes up 80% of our atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
So your voice, like, the voice we're hearing now is the voice on nitrogen.
Okay.
So your bass voice is based on nitrogen. And so helium makes your voice higher because it's less dense than nitrogen, and then I know what gas you're talking about, but I don't remember the name of it. But that one's more dense than nitrogen.
Uh-huh.
So that's why you have a deeper voice.
It's like that anti-drug commercial from the 90s. This is your voice on nitrogen. Sounds the same. It's fine.
Yeah. The only problem is if there's too much nitrogen. Because if it displaces all your oxygen, then you'll die.
Right.
But yeah, so when we're talking about like traditional farming, the way to get nitrogen into the soil is, like, there's three main ways. You got compost, you got manure, and you got nitrogen-fixing plants.
Okay, what's an example of a nitrogen-fixing plant?
Beans.
Okay.
Yeah, here it is. Alfalfa, beans, clover, peas, and soybeans all will enrich the soil with nitrogen.
Okay.
And so it's not the plant itself, actually. It's microorganisms that live in the roots of those plants.
Okay.
So if you pull up those plants and you look at the roots, they have little nodules in them.
Uh-huh.
And those little nodules are where the microorganisms live.
Okay.
And they're doing exactly what the Haber-Bosch process does, but in the soil. So it'll take the nitrogen from the air and convert it into a usable form. And the usable form is usually ammonia, or some kind of nitrate.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And that's 90% of naturally occurring fixed nitrogen comes from these soil bacteria, and then the other 10% comes from lightning strikes.
So, okay, real quick, just to backtrack, I'm just not catching up. If you didn't have manure and you didn't have compost, you would plant those other things to get the nitrogen that you need in the soil to plant, like to keep your farmland like viable?
Yes.
Okay.
So you can plant those, or you have to add something.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You said it also comes from lightning?
Yeah. So the other 10% comes from lightning strikes. Okay. And so the lightning strikes converts naturally, like the gases of nitrogen and oxygen in the air, and makes nitrous oxide
okay.
in the air with the lightning strike. And that makes 10% of the naturally occurring.
So it's got to be a lot of lightning that's happening. Like, just around the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, but then it's also not in the soil, so it's not as helpful.
So then it's just in the air.
It's just in the air, yeah.
Okay. I was going to say, so if, like, lightning strikes your field, you're going to have, like, a good crop yield now?
No.
Okay.
Absolutely not. You probably just killed all your plants. But yeah, so farmers of every area have had their own way of, like, fertilizing soils using animal manures. But in the 1840s...
Is there, like, nitrogen and human poop, too?
Yes.
Okay.
So you could, technically, but the other problem is, like, the diseases.
Yeah.
So then, because then it's going to be on your plants.
But you put animal poop on it. What's the difference? It's still poop.
You know, I have no idea. I'll be honest. I was just told it was about the germs.
Yeah.
I am not a farmer, so...
Yeah, I guess because most, like, viruses and viruses don't transfer from animals to humans. Most of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And if we do, then we're in trouble.
Yeah.
Because that's how you get, like, bird flu.
Right.
But yeah. So, in the 1840s, like I said, Europeans were traveling and colonizing and raiding different parts of the world for their resources, and fertilizer was one of them. So the best quality fertilizer was found in South America, specifically Peru, off the coast of Peru. There's a little archipelago of rocky islands where a bunch of seabirds lived and nested, and the island was just filled with a ton of their guano built over centuries or millennia that these birds have been sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
Sailors at the time wrote about how bad these islands smelled. and it sounded, they didn't describe it as this, but it sounded like a fair porta potty that has just been in the heat stewing.
Oh, God.
The Inca were the first ones to use this guano as fertilizer. So they would sail out to the island, collect it, and then that would help grow their mostly corn crop. And they valued the guano very highly, and they protected the resource. And so you were only allowed to visit the island when the birds were, you were not allowed to visit the island when the birds were breeding. And if you killed one of those birds, it was punishable by death.
Okay, so the whole, like, it smells really bad thing kind of reminds me of, like, you know when you pass a feedlot, and if you're, like, for some reason you're in the vehicle with some, like, really old country guy, he's always like, smells like money, and it's, like, the worst smell you've ever smelled in your life. It's pretty much that, but, like, you know, pirates.
Yes. yes, absolutely. And at first, though, it was not worth any money. Like, nobody wanted to buy this.
Right.
but, yeah, the local word that they called the bird poop was huanu. Which is where Europeans got the word guano,
uh-huh.
and they just spelled it differently because they don't care what things are actually called.
Yeah.
But yeah. And then, so the first ones to hear about this guano as fertilizer were the Spanish, because of course they were the first ones to the area in the 16th century. But they were really looking for gold and silver and looting for that. So they were like, eh.
Things that really don't have any value outside if they're just pretty.
Yes.
You can't really do a lot with them.
Who needs to feed people? We ain't gonna go get the shiny stuff.
Right. But it's shiny. I guess that's still true of a lot of people today.
The first European to take any interest in it was a German man named Alexander Humboldt. He took some of the guano back to Europe, where chemists analyzed it, and they found it to be high in urea and phosphates. But nobody really cared. They shipped a couple barrels over, but couldn't get anyone to buy the bird poop, and so they dumped it into the Thames.
Oh, God.
Also,
I love the old school idea of, like, we're just going to dump all our shit into the river. And I like how that's, like, the thread through all of humanity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Just dump it into the water. It's fine, right? There's so much water. Mm.
Yeah.
Well.
And the consequences of that is, of course, that, like, the Thames was, like, sterile. Like, there was no aquatic life in the Thames until, yeah. like, a couple years ago. Because I remember there was big news that someone was like, we saw a fish in the river. Yes, there's a, it was big news among biologists.
They've just been dumping things in there, like, yes. left, right, center.
Like, it used to catch on fire. Like, people didn't.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's a whole thing. Like, if you want to look into, like, the Water Quality Act, the reason the Water Quality Act was passed because rivers kept catching on fire.
Just because people would dump chemicals in there?
Yes. Specifically oil a lot.
Right.
So.
BP yeah. strikes again, huh?
I'm sure BP didn't exist early days. That's probably, like, standard oil.
It probably did, but it was, like, I mean, I'm sure standard oil is now BP. Like, you know, it's all right. the same. It's the same company. They just keep rebranding.
Well, right, because, like, Standard Oil got broken up during the monopoly stuff.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, BP was probably Standard Oil.
Yeah.
It just.
One of the subsidiaries. Just.
Exactly.
Ascendant.
Yeah. Finally, in 1824, the editor of the magazine American Farmer wrote about trying out the guano as fertilizer on his Maryland farm. Just like, this stuff's great. You should use it. And so after that, word spread. And eventually that's when the market started blowing up and everyone wanted to try it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Peruvian government in the 1800s was very unstable. They had had 24 regime changes from 1824 to 1841.
Okay.
So that's 24 government changes within a 20-year period.
Right, okay.
So, and then by the 1840s, the government had started to stabilize and realized the value of the islands had off their coast. So they nationalized the Chinchas Islands
mm-hmm.
and began handing out licenses to foreign companies that would ship slaves in to harvest the guano and then taxed the purchase of the guano as well. So they would tax the companies that to just do it in the first place and then
right.
tax the stuff that they were leaving to make money for the new country.
Okay.
And this was the start of what was called the guano boom. So Europe and the U.S. quickly became dependent on Peruvian fertilizer, and annual shipments at the peak were in the hundreds and thousands of pounds per year to the U.S. and as much to England.
So do you think all that money that was, like, flooding into the country is what caused all the instability in the government? Or?
No. So, I mean, the issue with the government was, I mean, directly the result of colonization, essentially,
right.
because once the local people tried to get control of the land again, you had different factions all fighting for control
yeah.
in a country that was not a country before that, right? They had separate territories
uh-huh.
of indigenous tribes, and then now all of a sudden they're one country, and so all these tribes who were not previously politically related are now a country. And so I think a lot of this instability comes from that.
Okay.
It was my understanding of why they were so unstable beforehand.
Gosh darn Europeans.
Yeah. But at this point, they kind of, once they had this money, it did help stabilize
uh-huh.
the country a little bit. So.
Well, and especially if they nationalized their most valuable resource, that makes sense.
Right, exactly. Because before, I don't think anybody claimed those islands
yeah.
before. So, yeah, and that was their number one resource because about everything else had been taken.
Yeah.
And there was not, as my understanding, Peru doesn't have a lot of farmland and there's not any valuable mines there, as far as I'm aware, like, or at least not enough to do the whole
yeah.
country's economy off
yeah.
of. But yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't super look into the before this window of their history.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that was my understanding.
Okay.
But this trade that they're founding, like the agricultural industry in the U.S. at the time, used slave labor to harvest the guano from the islands. The slaves on the Chinchas Islands were taken from China, where they were coerced into signing long-term labor contracts. They were forced to work at gunpoint for up to 20 hours a day, 6 days a week. And their contracts, and I put that in quote, were for 5 years. And they were paid 3 reals a day, which I did the math for it. They were paid 3 reals a day, two of which were withheld for food that were provided. So they really made 1 real
mm-hmm.
a day, which translated into modern American money is as little as a penny a day.
Oh, Jesus.
And of course, people often didn't make it through their 5-year contract, unfortunately. So, I had a hard time with this one because I kind of, it's a very dark thing, but I didn't want to like glaze over, I don't want to glaze over it.
Yeah.
And then this book that I got a lot of this information from, I do not recommend, because they actually, in the book, which was written in the 2000s, mm-hmm. used a racial slur to describe the people there.
Jesus Christ.
And I was like, who allowed this to be published? It was like written in 2005.
Oh, God. It was Bush, right? No. Yeah. Bush?
Yes. Baby Bush, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Baby Bush.
Old W. That's why they published it. He was like, I like this.
Yeah, and it threw me off because I was too, it was one that I had not heard before. And so I was like, what does this word mean? And then I Googled it and I was like, oh.
Now I want to know.
Oh, it's a slur.
You can tell me later.
But anyway, the supply of the guano on these islands only lasted so long. And by the late 1850s, there was almost none left. In 1856, the U.S. Congress actually passed the Guano Island Act, which allowed any U.S. citizen to claim any deserted island anywhere,
of course they did.
Anywhere of course in the they world did. And make it a U.S. territory.
See, I was like, this will be a nice break from the usual political rants that I'm listening to at this time, because I usually watch, like, all my news and stuff between, like, 5 and 7. I was like, this will be a nice break. Maybe I won't be so angry. No.
No, this is also, this could be a little political. Again. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
So, yeah. So, Americans just started claiming islands left and right. Over 100 islands were claimed under this act, with 10 islands are still claimed by the U.S. today. So, it's 10 of the islands are still ours, mostly in the Pacific Ocean, but some Caribbean islands were claimed as well. And, of course, this was horribly misused. Many of the islands, because it was supposed to be an uninhabited island, right? Yeah. Many of them were inhabited or claimed by other nations, and none of them ever had any quantity of guano.
They just bought nothing.
Many of these islands became key in the Pacific theater of World War II. So, like, the famous Midway Island, right? Battle of Midway.
Uh-huh.
That was claimed under this act. One island was used by the CIA to broadcast anti-communist radio into Cuba. And the one island became the, and I quote, the toxic waste dump of the world, because we took all of the chemical weapons from World War II.
And dumped it there?
And just dumped it there. I think it was World War II. It was World War I or World War II. We just put all the chemical weapons on this one island.
So does that island have a name?
I don't know. Let's see. It's in the Maldives.
I want to name it something like, I don't know. I mean, you can't really name it after Donald Trump because it existed before him, but like, what's an island full of poop, you know? Like, what's an island full of the most toxic, hazardous materials ever known to man?
I think it's called Tila Fushi. Oh, no, that's the lagoon.
The original name.
The lagoon is Tila Fushi.
And that's where Godzilla is going to come from eventually?
Probably, yes. It seems like the locals just call it Rubbish Island, so, which I'm not surprised
by. That's a reasonable name. That's about right. I mean, what else do you call an island like that?
I mean, honestly, it's not even your trash, so, like,
yeah. It'd be like if somebody came to your house and just dumped all of their trash of, like, week-old pizza and diapers and stuff just, like, on your couch.
I feel like it's worse than that. It's like somebody... It's like if I, as a chemist, took all of my chemical waste and dumped it on your couch.
Yeah.
Because, like, it's extra toxic, right? Like, it's not even just, like, normal household waste. It's literal poison that they just dumped on their backyard.
I mean, what are you supposed to do with this stuff, though? I think that's the problem with science. Is all the stuff that everybody created, you never thought, like, nobody ever thought, okay, what do we do with it if it's bad?
Right. I mean,
like, how do we contain it?
Because mm-hmm.
that wasn't the point. The point was to, I don't know, invent things to make money.
Yeah, well, I mean, most of the stuff on that island is from weaponry. So,
right.
I mean, that wasn't even to make money. That was just,
Well, war always makes money for somebody.
That's fair. At least a lot of, and we're going to actually talk about Haber. Haber is the, considered the father of chemical warfare, and mm-hmm. he is one of the people that invents the Haber-Bosch process.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he made a lot of money from that, and then he invented all of these chemical weapons as a soldier. Like, he was part of the army, like, so it wasn't, he didn't even make that much money.
Because he was in the army?
Yeah, so he was...
So he should have been an independent contractor. He would have made so much more money.
I don't know if that was a thing in
no.
in World War One, at least.
That's probably better. I mean, it's a better way to do it. That's how it probably should be done.
But yeah, he's famous for saying, like, a chemist belongs to his country during war and to the world during peacetime.
Okay.
That was yeah. his whole thing. Yeah, he had a very sad life, to be honest. For many reasons. But he wasn't really a good person. So it's kind of like, I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like, somebody had a really horrible life, but they also murdered a lot of people. So you're like,
yeah.
But like, it also had a lot of collateral damage that was not him, if that makes any sense. So
it didn't impact him directly.
I mean, it did, but not to the same level.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Like his family had a really hard time with it, because a lot of his, like, he had two wives, I think, and they were both chemists, and his first wife killed herself over what Fritz Haber did. And that's why, I mean, like, it's collateral damage. Yeah. Like, that's the tragedy, right? Like, I don't feel bad for Haber, but, like, all the people in his life that were affected, that's the tragedy.
Yeah.
But anyway, to be back on topic, as people got increasingly desperate for fertilizer, armies started getting involved. And then we got into the guano wars. So the first ones up were the U.S. tried to claim the Chinches Islands, but the Peruvian army was quickly able to get them to back down. Then a Spanish army, or a Spanish admiral started a real battle in 1863 when he began occupying the islands. Both Peru and Chile quickly declared war on their former colonizers under the command of a former Confederate admiral from Virginia.
And this is what year? So this is 1863. After the Civil War?
1863. Yeah.
After the Civil War, then? Because I know that a lot of the... Because that's why there's actually a lot of white nationalists in South America, especially in, like, Peru.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the Confederate generals, a lot of the Confederates, went to South America because they could still have slaves and all that stuff. Like, yes. They could still live the life that they wanted to live.
Because
mm-hmm. they'll have, like, a lot of the, like, streets and stuff are named after Confederates. They have, like, celebrations, like, big festivals, where it's, like, they're Peruvian people, but they have the Confederate flag, and they do, like, all the kind of indigenous dances and stuff, but to, like, Dixie songs. Like, it's real.
Really?
It's really, yeah.
Mm. I knew after World War II a lot of Nazis went to South America, but I didn't realize that a lot of Confederates went there, too, kind of until I did
this.
Well,
and a lot of them, too, because they were trying to escape the conviction, like the...
Right.
Yeah, everything that was going to happen to them because they committed sedition against the country.
I mean, same thing with the Nazis during World War II. Yeah. They were fleeing the Nuremberg trials.
Right. Yeah.
So, for whatever reason, the South America was the place to go.
It's a beacon of hope for if you're a white supremacist.
Yeah, it's wild. But this Spanish admiral ended up losing because the admiral from Virginia managed to capture one of his ships, and so it was a whole failed occupation, and the Spanish admiral ended up committing suicide out of shame. But this marked South America's independence from Spain. So this was, like, the first time that a South American country managed to militarily defeat a European country. Uh-huh. So it was the first time it marked because they were independent, but, like, their real independence. Like,
yeah.
they were able to stand on their own against invaders, essentially.
Right.
By 1870, there was no more Peruvian fertilizer, and Peru became bankrupt since most of their income was from the guano trade.
Uh-huh.
Today, the islands are mostly bare, and the government protects the birds and will occasionally let people harvest some of the guano, but there's not nearly as... It's not a trade like uh-huh. it used to be. this shifted all of the intention into a desert, the Atacama Desert. With no more guano, the next best thing was South American sodium nitrate from this desert. Originally, the sodium nitrate was sought as not as fertilizer, but as an explosive.
Of course.
Because gunpowder's major ingredient is potassium nitrate. And in Europe and the U.S. needed to supply their armies in the 1860s. Uh-huh. Because especially, you know, in the U.S. we had the Civil War. And then also, like, the westward expansion, we used a lot of explosives to blast our way through mountains.
Yeah.
England controlled the world's largest supply of potassium nitrate in India. The most important export of the East India Trading Company was not spices, but potassium nitrate, also called saltpeter. Now, sodium nitrate is not as reactive as potassium nitrate, but chemists figured out how to synthesize the potassium nitrate from the South American sodium nitrate. Chemists also figured out how to make nitric acid from sodium nitrate, which was the basic ingredient for the next generation of what we call today high explosives,
okay,
which were invented by Alfred Nobel, which is the Nobel Prize guy. So England, Germany, France, and the U.S. all start scrambling to buy pieces of this desert to mine and refine for the nitrate. And so this used to be like a barren desert with one small town named Inquique. Which quickly blew up into one of the biggest cities in the area with 12,000 inhabitants, mostly Chilean people who came to work at one of the new, there were 9 new steam-powered refineries built by foreign powers. Okay. So none of them were owned by locals.
Right.
All of this, again, was facilitated by the Peruvian government, who were giving out licenses and levying taxes on the trade. Peru was still in financial trouble. They had to take out a massive loan based on the shipping of the guano. But with no more guano, the nitrate trade was not making enough to stabilize the country. The Chilean workers and the Europeans that were owning these factories were looking for a way to get free of the Peruvian government and let Chile take over the area instead. Chile was much more stable than Peru at the time. Peru had been, again, ravaged by the Spanish and had a rich and corrupt ruling class. And then most of its citizens were living in poverty. So they had a few really rich people and then everyone else was impoverished. And a lot of them were native people. Chile had a lot fewer native people and were mostly populated and controlled by immigrants from England and Germany. Mm-hmm. So, of course, that was looked as more favorable for the foreign investors who wanted to have the control over the nitrate refining operation.
What?
A small strip of the desert was also owned by Bolivia. So all three countries began, like, sizing each other up to see who would control the operation. Bolivia secretly sided with Peru against Chile. And the nitrate war started in 1879. So there's a whole war over this.
They were mining it from the ground?
Yes.
Okay. I was like, we're not talking about the birds anymore. It's the ground. Okay. The sand.
Yes. Okay. Ryan called it the poop wars, which I thought was funny.
Yeah. I mean, that's accurate. That's what they're fighting over.
There's at least a poop battle. Over just the islands.
Yeah.
But they just lost really fast.
Yeah.
So both sides were fighting over the major port at Inquique. The battle for the desert was actually fought on the sea. The first major battle was between the Peruvian ironclad ship, the Huascar, and was captained by Miguel Maria Grau. And accompanied by another ironclad ship, the Independencia. Chile did not have the same quality of ship, but they had incredible courage, and their corvette ship, the Esmeralda, which was captained by Arturo Prat. Grau attacked first, targeting the Esmeralda, and then there was another Chilean ship that tried to retreat that was chased by the Peruvian ship, the Independencia. The Huascar quickly had the Esmeralda pinned against the coastline and hammered the ship with cannon fire. On the coastline, there were Peruvians from the port city. They came to attack the Esmeralda too. So they had the ship pinned to the coastline, and the people on the coast were taking out cannons and then firing from land to attack the ship.
I think if I was on that ship, I'd be like, you know, I'm not doing this. This is dumb. I'm just going to go. I'm leaving.
I mean, how would you leave, though?
You just jump overboard now. You just go by.
I get it.
And then try to swim. Because either way, you're probably going to die. Like,
that's fair. That's fair.
I just don't know that I believe in anything strongly, especially not, like, country. Like, I don't believe in anything strongly enough to die for it. Like, I have principles and all, but there's not a lot of things I would die for. Not for money or something. Like, real actual freedom for people, I might, but still probably not.
The ships traded cannon fire for over two and a half hours until the Esmeralda was dead in the water. Usually at this point, Pratt, who was the captain of the Esmeralda, would have surrendered, but he had promised his men that he would not lower the Chilean flag, so he charged onto the deck of the Huascar and charged for the bridge of the ship and took the Peruvian officers by surprise. A shot rang out, and Arturo Pratt fell to one knee. And then they continued to fire until Pratt died on the deck of the Huascar. The Esmeralda was rammed one last time. The ship began to sink, still flying the Chilean flag. In the end, the crew of 198 people only had 50 survivors, and both sides still claimed victory.
That's not bad, though. It's still like a quarter of your people that were on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
That's not horrible.
Yeah, and then Arturo Pratt was... Is seen as like the is like a national hero now. So they call him the El Cabrero de los Mares, the Knight of the Seas. Uh-huh.
Can you spell Cabrero for me?
C A B A L L E R O.
Caballero.
Caballero. Okay, El Caballero. I'm so bad at this.
C A B A R E L L O.
C-A-B-A-L-L-E-R-O. Caballero?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've been doing good on all the other pronunciations that sound right. I was like, hold on, that one doesn't sound.
Okay. Also, I was wrong. It's not Pratt. It was Grau. Grau earned the nickname. El Caballero de los Mares. The Knight of the Sea. But yeah, so both sides claimed victory because while Chile lost the Esmeralda, Peru lost the Independencia because as it was chasing the other ship, it hit a reef and sank. So as you're having this like epic battle, the other one's like, dang it, we hit a reef. after the battle, the Huascar ruled the west coast of South Africa and South America, and Grau earned the nickname the Knight of the Seas. Chile started losing ship after ship, and knew their only chance of winning was to sink or capture the Huascar. So on October 8th, 1879, eight of Chile's warships descended on the Huascar, where it was expected to have like this lengthy, epic battle again. But it ended quickly because one of the Chilean soldiers managed to shoot Grau and some of his officers. So 2 hours later, the Huascar was captured. Because I think it was, like, one of the first shots fired, like, killed Grau, and everyone was like, oh, no, what do we do now? Yeah.
But plus, like, if your army boss dies, you kind of have to give up, like.
Right. I mean, unless you have, like, a clear second in command.
Right.
If that guy dies.
You said they killed all the other officers, too, right?
Yeah, they managed to kill a lot of them, a lot of the officers very quickly, like, with some... From what it sounded like, just, like, lucky shots. Like, they weren't even, like, again, they were expecting to have this really long battle.
Yeah.
And then, because I don't even know if they know who shot him. Like, that's the thing. Like, it was just some random person managed to get a lucky shot.
Well, the way that you described this Huascar guy, he sounds like he would be, like, the first person to get out there and attack. Like, if somebody's coming, like, he's going to be up on there in the front, you know, not hiding away like some other people.
Yeah. And I mean,
definitely would.
I think that was, like, kind of the vibe of the time was very much like, you know, you're out and out with your people, not somewhere else planning things, you know, you're actually on the ship. And so now with Chile controlling the Huascar, they controlled the seas. And then 15 months later, Chile marched on Lima, the capital of Peru, which finally ended the war. Peru ceded all their nitrate-rich desert to Chile, and so Chile became the sole controller of the most important resource in the area. Now, the Chilean nitrate was used by the United States to continue westward expansion by making the high explosives and to push railroad lines and roads. They carved Mount Rushmore and blasted out the Panama Canal with Chilean nitrate. In Europe, the Chilean nitrate was being used to grow crops because there was no more guano, and the population was rapidly increasing, so crop yields needed to improve so they could feed all these people. Mm-hmm. And so by 1900, Chile produced two-thirds of the entire world's fertilizer.
By 1900? Okay.
Mm-hmm. The two biggest buyers of Chilean fertilizer were England and Germany. So England at least had all of its colonies to help produce their food, so they had a lot of land. But Germany was only formed as an independent country in 1870, and so it did not have any colonies. And German soil is not known for being rich. So they had poor soil, and they were very dependent on the fertilizer. So in 1900, Germany was shipping 350,000 tons a year. By 1912, that had nearly tripled to 900,000 tons, which was twice what the entire United States shipped.
They still don't really have a lot of, like, produce and stuff.
Yes.
Because I'm thinking, I was like, I don't know that anything grows, like, you're not getting mangoes from Germany.
Absolutely not.
You're not getting anything good, maybe cabbage, but you can grow cabbage here. Like,
yeah.
Cabbage is a pretty forgiving vegetable to grow. Okay.
Yeah, right, it's just a cold weather crop, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's the other thing is, like, the growing season
really
is very short.
They don't have a climate for that, either.
Exactly. So, because, like, at least England, right, like, they, like, the sun never sets on England, so they have so much.
Yeah, they have enough moisture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they, and in England itself, yeah, they have a lot more moisture and rain.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Okay, I do have a question, though.
Okay.
And maybe this is not applicable to the situation. What is China doing?
So honestly, China has, from what I was reading about farming, China has had a really great system of fertilizer themselves.
They're not importing any of this fertilizer from other places. And I know they have their own, like they were the ones who like invented fireworks, right?
Yes.
So they already have like, the technology, I guess, or the know-how to make explosives and to make gunpowder and stuff like that. So they didn't really have to get involved with this.
Yes.
So are they ever part of, like, the history of this process?
I wouldn't be surprised if, like, modern day now they have a Haber-Bosch, factories, but they don't come into this story at all.
Okay.
My understanding is they had traditional farming practices that they did not need the fertilizer.
Yeah.
Like, because they used animal manure. I kind of vaguely read about it, is that they used animal manure and had practices that.
Why would these other countries, like, was China just not offering up the secrets to be like, hey, you don't need to, like, go to war for bird poop? Because you can just do this thing that we've been doing for, like, hundreds of years.
Well, so if you're thinking about the diet as well, right? Like, because China mostly, their staple was rice.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. I don't know why China did not, like, the practices of farming.
Selfish. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, they probably just didn't ask them. They were just like, you're doing your own thing.
You guys are doing great. We're going to be over here fighting over bird poop. Don't worry. It's fine.
Yes. I think that was basically the whole shebang. Was like, they're doing their own thing.
The Chinese were just like, look at these idiots.
Honestly, they don't come into the story at all. So I really don't know what they were doing. Yeah, with the demands rising, refineries in Chile kept building better and better refineries. And so for about 20 years, everyone thought the nitrate issue had been solved. Everything was great. But anyone paying attention, it became quickly apparent that the desert nitrate would soon run out, just like the guano had run out, because it's a finite resource. Yeah.
Like everything is.
Yeah. And in 18...
except for the wind and the sun, but...
Yeah. You know, I mean, it depends on what you call finite, because it does end eventually.
That's... Yeah, but by the time the sun ends, we're not going to be here anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Exactly. It's just like...
when the wind ends, we're not going to be here.
If the wind ends, we have other problems.
Yeah. We have bigger problems than... Did you, Kelsey was telling me this, this is just kind of a random side story anecdote, that, there was a story about I think she was a sixth grade science teacher, believe it or not, who, went to a city council meeting because they were talking about, like, putting windmills into the county or whatever, and she was like, I don't want windmills in the county because what if it soaks up all the wind? We shouldn't do solar panels because what if it soaks up all the sun? You should not be a teacher, lady. You should be teaching gym.
Yes.
Soaking up all the sun. Are you a nut? Are you...
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the Texas education system for you. Public education.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm in my hometown. They were thinking about putting wind turbines up.
Turbines is what I meant, yeah.
Yeah, wind turbines up, and people were like, it's gonna ruin all the scenery. And I'm
who
like,
who cares?
I'm like, I don't know. Is it just me? But I like how wind turbines look. I feel like they look kind of majestic. Yeah.
They look, I mean, they look way better than oil rigs.
Yeah.
Because people didn't want to put, like, I mean, there are a fair amount now of wind turbines in West Texas, but there are a lot of people that, like, don't like them because they think they're ugly. It's like, okay, you think these oil rigs look nice?
Yeah, because those, I mean, they're smaller, yeah. I guess, but, like...
there's also nothing to see out there.
Yeah, it's not like the... See, at least in my
home... we have mountains and trees. It's just like, oh, that mesquite bush, that looks just like the one next to it. That looks just like the one 200 yards away.
Yes.
There's no scenery here.
Yes.
It's dirt.
At least in Tennessee, we have scenery to protect. I'm sorry, but, yeah. Like, West Texas, it's just, there's no... it's not even,
it's
like,
ugly.
It's not even, like, any nice rocks. Like, because, like,
no.
If you go to, like, New Mexico, I feel like you at
the
least get nice rock formations.
Yeah.
But we don't got nothing like that.
No.
But, yeah, at least in Tennessee, like, there's the Rocky, or the Smoky Mountains.
Yeah.
So, like, but I don't know. I feel like it just adds to it, not, I get it. But I like how they look, so maybe
yeah.
That's just
well,
me.
That's, like, a big, like, so Donald Trump has, like, a huge... vendetta against wind turbines.
Mm-hmm.
He's always talking about like how he hates wind turbines. He doesn't want to put wind turbines, but it's because like he takes it personally because he built a golf course in Ireland,
mm-hmm.
and the Irish government decided to put wind turbines close enough to his golf course that he could see them. So now he hates wind turbines. So it's just
that doesn't
like,
surprise
he talks about them
was
a
it
lot.
Ireland or Scotland?
I think it's Ireland.
Okay, because I'm sure. There's a whole story of him trying to make a golf course in Scotland,
uh-huh.
and the local Scottish people were like, no, you don't. Because
yeah.
There's, like, one guy specifically who has a bunch of land right where he wants to build the golf
uh-huh.
course. And so, and he was like, no, you can't have my fucking house.
Yeah.
And so, but, like, the Trump tried to get them to take it through, like, eminent domain and all this
yeah.
stuff. But I guess in Scotland, to take things by eminent domain, you have to go talk to the owner in person, right? And so this guy sold his land to a scientist who was going to Antarctica for like 2 years. And of course they
like,
can't.
I don't know, man. Not my problem anymore.
Exactly. So like, and this dude was like, yeah, I mean, they got to talk to me in person. And I'm not going to be in Scotland for at least 2 more years. I'm going to be chilling with some penguins. I was like, that is the pettiest thing I've
ever
heard.
There's no McDonald's in Antarctica, Trump. You're not going to want to go, dude.
Yeah, so I just thought that was the pettiest thing, but
yeah,
I loved it
I love
so
that.
Much.
I love that energy. That's why, like, there's a lot of things when I hear, like, stories about, like, Irish people or Scottish people, I'm like, I can identify with this. Because they're usually angry about something, and I feel that anger deep inside of them.
Yes, yes. I would love to go work in Scotland, Ireland, either one.
Yeah.
I would love to go there because it's on my list. Like, when I become a faculty member, it's on my list to apply
yeah.
to all the universities over there. Right, so the nitrate was running out. The guano had run out. And so in 1898, a man named Sir William Crookes, who was the president of the British Academy of Sciences, made a very grim prediction that humans would start starving to death in large numbers by the 1930s if something were not done.
Because there's no poop left.
Yes. so now not everyone believed him. A lot of people thought he was exaggerating, not unlike people who still deny climate change. Right. And so he challenged scientists to find a way to tap into the nitrogen gas in the air and turn it into fertilizer. So we knew that those were the same substance, but like one is inert, we can't use it. Well, at this time we couldn't do it. So
is that what the Haber-Bosch process is? They figured that out?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So the Haber-Bosch process turns that nitrogen that's in the air into fertilizer we can use.
Okay.
And so the first attempt at turning nitrogen into a usable form looked to nature to burn the nitrogen out using a ton of electricity to create artificial lightning bolts to convert the nitrogen into nitric acid. And nitric acid is, of course, corrosive and harmful to handle. And then the cost was super high because electricity was really expensive. Like, electricity is still pretty expensive now, but, I mean, it was really expensive at turn of the century. And so that was the first one to – the first process. And it works, but, again, it's
really
just –
sustainable.
Exactly. And it makes nitric acid, like, that's just – you can't put nitric acid directly on your plants. Like, it's just...
Yeah, you just put it in the ocean like everything else. Fine.
Don't put nitric acid in the ocean either. Wilhelm Ostwald was the first one to try to innovate the production of ammonia using a then-new field called catalysis in 1900. So Ostwald heard the prediction of William Crookes, and he's like, I'm going to do this with this new kind of chemistry called catalysis. And so, just to explain a little bit, a catalyst is a chemical that lowers the activation energy of a reaction.
Oh, I know what that is.
Yeah.
Okay. That word sounds familiar. I remember that. Okay.
Yeah. And so, basically, the goal is to need less heat and to get it to react faster. So, like, that way we don't have to use lightning.
Yeah.
We can use something else. So he built a reactor that had a heater and an input for nitrogen and hydrogen gases. And then he pressurized it with a bicycle pump.
Sometimes you just got to use what you have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just loved it. I just imagine him like bicycle pumping it. And he tried a bunch of catalysts. But the one that seemed to work was a piece of iron wire. By pressurizing a container, heating it, and cooling the system, he found an appreciable amount of ammonia was produced. And so he quickly patented the invention and tried to sell it to a company called BASF, which was Germany's biggest chemical company at the time. And before agreeing to buy it, they had a young chemist named Bosch test the machine. So after testing it, Bosch found that Ostwald was not actually producing any ammonia, and that the ammonia he thought he was producing was just contamination in his machine.
Oh.
So at first Ostwald thought that Bosch was doing something wrong.
Yeah.
So he was like, "Oh, let me send you a sample of the catalyst that I'm using," because Bosch was just using a piece of iron.
Right.
And so he's like, I'm going to send you my iron because that's what made it work. And so, you know, Bosch tested this new piece of iron wire and then it would produce some ammonia. But then when he tried to do it a second time, nothing would happen.
Okay.
And so this would happen multiple times. Ostwald would send Bosch a sample. Bosch would try it, and he tried it over and over again to get it to work. It would work the first time and then it wouldn't work again. And so finally he went to the
books.
That's
science, right?
Yeah.
That's the whole scientific process.
Yeah.
So if it doesn't repeat, it's not real.
Exactly. So he's like, what is happening here? Because he's getting ammonia the first time and then never again.
Yeah.
And that's weird. And so he went to the books and he looked up reactions between iron, nitrogen, ammonia, and hydrogen. And what he discovered was in the literature, if you heat iron in the presence of ammonia, you get iron nitride. If you heat iron nitride in the presence of hydrogen, which would be these conditions, you would get the ammonia back.
Uh-huh.
So essentially that wire that Ostwald was giving him was iron nitride, not iron. And so when you heat it, it would release its ammonia. You would then just get regular iron. And then so when you tried to repeat it, the iron itself doesn't do anything.
Because you need it needs to be iron nitride?
No, because the iron nitride was, it was just releasing the ammonia trapped in the iron nitride. It wasn't making any new ammonia. So the nitrogen and hydrogen gases were just in the machine. And then this piece of wire, when you heat it, it released ammonia. And that was it. So the ammonia, instead of coming from a reaction of the gases, was coming from the wire.
Yeah.
And you could only get one equivalent out, and then it would stop working.
Yeah.
So it wasn't actually, it wasn't catalyzing anything.
Right.
It was just releasing what was already trapped in it.
It was just a light show at that point. Just.
Yes. A very complicated way. So, and then, of course, BASF, the company, was really disappointed.
It's like when people take, like, dried pasta noodles and reform it into a dough to make pasta again.
People do that?
It's like a, it's, people don't do that, but it was, like, a dumb trend thing that was on TikTok or something. I follow a lot of the food people.
I've never heard of this trend. Is it good? What was the purpose? Just to show you could do it?
Yeah, like, that you could do it, but it's like, also you could just use the pasta to make the pasta. Instead of crushing it, making it into a dough to make it into a pasta again, because it was already pasta.
So they just, like, rehydrated it before they boiled it, essentially?
Yeah.
That seems silly.
Yeah.
Seems like a waste of time.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
That's what this is. That's what it reminds me of.
That's fair. This was a waste of time. So, yeah, but, you know, BASF was disappointed that Oswald's device didn't work, but that gave Bosch a boost to his credit, you know, because he was, like, a young chemist. Like, nobody had heard of him before this. And so he was a young guy, but he kind of got a small promotion from this, essentially, because it saved BASF a lot of money from trying to develop something that doesn't work.
Right.
And so Oswald ends up withdrawing his patent application, and he stops trying to solve the nitrogen problem because he was, like, really embarrassed.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good reason to be embarrassed.
Oswald later compared the search for fixed nitrogen to the search for the Philosopher's Stone for alchemists. So alchemists tried...
Everybody knows Harry Potter found that, okay?
But historically, alchemists tried to turn something that was not gold into gold. And so, in a way, this was even better by turning air into fertilizer and explosives, right? Yeah. And so many alchemists end up... Historically, alchemists ended up really sick from heavy metal poisoning a lot. Or corrupted by greed, or obsessed with the search for this, and then they do nothing else.
Yeah.
And so it's just a cursed endeavor, essentially, is what he was saying. That's where we end part one on the Haber-Bosch process, just setting up why the fertilizer was an important thing. Yeah. So, what do you think? Wars fought over fertilizer.
I mean, it's a lot more intense than I thought, because I was like, why is it 3 hours? I was trying to figure out, I was like, I'm not trying to be like, it shouldn't be 3 hours, but I'm like, this is, I don't understand why. But now I understand, because there's a lot of things going on. I think I always think of science outside of the context of history, like it's its own separate thing, and I forget that everything is so intertwined. Like,
absolutely. I mean, that's
because
part of this.
The reason, like you were saying earlier, like the reason for a lot of scientific advances is because of like government, like because the government's
because of
like,
war.
Well, we need this, so somebody has to make it, and that's going to be you.
Exactly,
we're going to pay you to do it, and you better do it, or we'll kill you.
Yeah, and this story is actually interesting because this is, like, one of the first times that it's not the government exactly driving it forward.
But it's still, like, the global economy.
Yes. Yeah, it's a very global story.
Yeah.
Unlike a lot of other things.
Yeah.
Because I didn't expect it to be this in-depth until I did it. Because, and by the time I got through writing part three, I was like, you know, where do I stop this story? Because I can go all the way into World War II if I want, but I stop after World War I. Because at that point, the Haber-Bosch process gets out, essentially.
Yeah.
Like, not just one person is doing it. It was really hard for me to pick a stopping point. Because at what point do you stop talking about...
Right, because science is always going to continue to develop. Like,
because Because then you can go into Haber's life. Like, do I go into Haber's life about him being the father of chemical warfare? Do I go into Basha's life and his stuff later on? Like, there's so many, like, little branches to this story that you can go to. So I'm trying to keep it, like, on rails.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Haber and Basha are probably going to get their own episodes later on.
Yeah.
Like, because their life affects so much.
Yeah.
Especially Haber. Like, Haber's life. I feel like he lived, like, 8 lives in the length of his life. Because, like, he'll be in episode 2, and then he's gone. Like, off to do something else. Like, he's just like, here's the Haber Basha process. I'm going to do.
Make things that kill people.
So, yeah. But this is the end of episode 1, and it is kind of a heavy one. Are you feeling okay?
Yeah, I just feel like, I mean, I knew I was going to feel dumb. But it's just, you named a lot of dates and times, and I'm just like, oh, this is exactly what I was not good at in school. So I'm trying to think of it, like, the historical context of this. Because I need to know, like, I mean, I only know when, like, a few things happen.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm not really sure. Like, World War I, I'm not really positive about when that happened. The only war that I really know happened was the War of... was it 1812?
Yes.
See, I don't even know. That's the only one I know because it's got the year in the thing. But other than that, I'm like, I'm not good at dates and people.
Well, in good news,
I think I kept up.
There's no test. So after this, you won't have to remember it.
I mean, I probably would remember it better if there was a test. I had this teacher in college. I can't remember what class it was, but I guess gave me the terminology for the way that I approached most of my education and the way that a lot of people, especially Americans that are, you know, because we're so invested in testing, the concept of academic bulimia, where you just take in all the information, you take in all the information, and then you just throw it up on the test.
Yes.
And then you don't retain it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, I feel like that's what I'm doing right now. And I'm trying to, like, use this and remember it and figure out how to, like, apply it.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, I don't know how to apply any of this to my life either.
Well, I mean,
so.
I think it's important to know, like, because of global warming and everything, like, I think a lot of people don't understand why it's so serious, because it's like, yeah, you can get all the oil out of the earth that you want. You can burn up all the coal.
Right.
But we're all going to die. Like,
right.
Even if you have $10 million, if there's no water left on this planet, you can't drink that $10 million.
Exactly.
Like, it's important that we have crops. It's important that we have agriculture that's sustainable for the entire planet so we don't all die horrible deaths of starvation.
Yes.
So that's fun.
A heavy note to end a heavy episode. Thank you for listening to the first episode of the Haber Basha process, and thank you for joining me. Is there anything you would like to promote about Laugh Hub City or anything
like
that?
Just follow us on Facebook, we're Laugh Hub City, Lubbock Comedy. On Instagram, we're Laugh Hub City _official. On Twitter, I think we're Laugh Hub _sit.
All right. Well, thank you. And join me next time for Cowboy Chemistry, and we'll talk about part 2 of the Haber Basha process.
Apoptosis going mad, my liver's gonna fail. Maybe it's from the radium I use to paint my nails. Well, say you hate me, carbon date me, throw me in the sea. I'll be back with time because I'm made of stardust and chemistry. Of stardust and chemistry.